grand unifying theory in biology is total chance organic evolution. GUT. Understand? And as we said, in the 18th and 17th centuries, cosmology dominated scientific thought. With Darwin in the 19th century, biology came to dominate scientific thought. And we have seen the failure of chemistry and physics to solve the problem of biology in prebiotic or evolution or chemical evolution. That is the transition from physics and chemistry to biology. In other words, physics and chemistry applies to the non-living world as well as to the living world. But the gap from simple physics, that is, chemical evolution, prebiotic evolution, is an attempt to explain biology in terms of chemistry and physics, that might be us. And we've seen the failure of that. I have more to say about that in another. This is the first edition of the syllabus of an expanded it's not a computer. But but having understood that, we come now to a consideration of the phenomenon of the growth of science as a mythology. Now, the last thing I talked about, you recall, was this science fiction idea of interplanetary travel. And the point I want to make here is the fact that that kind of science fiction, the fact that evolution, the fact that textbooks will still hold, will still put the Miller-Urey and the Fox experiments in there and try to say, well, this is how life, this is spontaneous generation. And the fact that the textbooks will still try to hold to man to amoeba to man, you know, or orthogenic straight line evolution. Try to speak of it, to write about it, as if a continuum existed. And as a matter of fact, a continuum does not exist. The fact that those things hold, added, and also considering the fact that the universal, almost Western belief that man shall conquer the stars, traveling in space. This is symptomatic of a mythology. In fact, the theory of total chance organic evolution, coupled with the idea of chemical evolution, added to the idea added to the problem of the origin of man. First of all, you understand I taught you there's three phases, and to answer one is not to answer the other two. There are three questions, the origin of matter. We talked about the origin of the universe, very serious. Then there's the question, once you got a universe, then you got the question of chemical evolution to produce life, fundamental life. Second, then you got the problem of biotic evolution, prebiotic evolution, chemical evolution, biotic evolution. Solve one, you understand? The solve one is not to solve the other two. And as a matter of fact, what is happening is that the certainty in high places about the likelihood of ever solving any of them is decreasing. Time was when, you know, as I said, in the 19th of the century, this was a promise, you know, we're just long, just, you know, give us a couple more weeks and we'll have it. But they're not saying that anymore. Now, and so in the light of the decline of scientific assurance, why is there a rise? A rise in scientism or the science fiction mentality. Well, science has become a sacred word today. Just as the 17th century was a theological age, and not the 20th century is an age of scientism. Science is the god. And so we come to the mythology of science, and I follow Rushdoony in this. This is the best work, in my opinion, on the subject. When we talk about the mythology of science, look at our syllabus now. What do we mean by mythology? We mean the explanation offered by an age or a culture of life and its origins. Now, the word myth does not mean, let's be very careful about this. The word myth does not, in this context, we use myth in this context. It's like when you use myth in a context of cultural anthropology. It does not mean that it's false. Myth describes how it functions. The word, now we normally, in theology, we are attuned, we conservatives are attuned to hearing the word myth, meaning that it's false. You know, the Genesis myths. So we've got to change gears in our thinking and understand that when we're talking about it here, myth simply means the explanation. Myth speaks not of whether it's true or false, but how it functions. And a myth is a functional term. That is, a myth functions to explain origins. Now, it might be a true myth or a false myth. You understand that? In this sense, Genesis 1 is a myth. In this sense, in terms of function, it functions to explain origins. Now, and this is a, because myth means the explanation of life, of origins, and particularly the origin of life, to speak of the mythology of science is something of an oxymoron. You know, an oxymoron is, it's a self-contradicting statement. You know, George Will says that the term Russian journalist is an oxymoron. Because there is no journalism, no such thing as journalism in Russia, because every journalist is an agent, functions as an agent of the state. Whereas an American journalist sees their job to try to critique the government. All a journalist in Russia can ever be is simply a mouthpiece for the government.
By an American definition of the word journalist.
Oh, well, yeah, by any definition.
The Russian's definition of the word journalist might be.
And that means a
spokesman.
You see, the difference between the two, the very speaks is a well named spokesman. When he speaks for the president, everybody understands he's simply the president's mouthpiece. The journalists are not called upon to take what he says as gospel. Did you see George Will, I suppose this is popular in mind, but George Will makes exceptions to the American networks who will often interview Russian so-called journalists on their TV show without ever telling anybody that these men are simply agents of the state. Therefore, they deliver the party line that and nothing else. Well, again, they're not journalists. So that's what he said. Yeah, the term Russian journalist is an oxymoron. It's self-trying to state. Well, back to my point. The term mythology of science is an oxymoron in a sense. Why?
It's truly science, not scientistic. But it had to be fact. And the word couldn't be myth.
It's true. Let me ask you a question. What do you think? Now, see if I'm touching. Somebody tell me why the term mythology of science. What is mythology? An explanation of origins of life.
Oh, science is not explaining origins.
Now, so you may be provided the answer. Only one phrase is enough. The rest of it is hard, everybody else is hard. So, which one is it? He said. There's a man who was in there. Take the letters. Yeah. Well, you want to add to that?
Basically, what you said. Science only deals with what can be observed, and obviously no one observed the origin, so science can't deal with it.
As Popper said, that evolution, by its definition, because it's not falsifiable, can never be anything but a philosophy of biology. By its very nature, can never be anything but a philosophy of biology. Okay, so first of all, we got the mythology of science is something of an oxymoron, self-contradictory.
Now, here's an expanded definition. The attempt of a culture to overcome history. Now think with me on this, what we're saying. That is to negate the forces and ravages of time and to make the universe amenable and subject to man. You see, the purpose of a myth functions, I want to not only to explain origins, but to overcome history in the sense that man it's an attempt to overcome history. That is to say that what has been is not going to necessarily be what shall be, because man doesn't like what has been. What has been is a mess. Well, kind of, now stick with me on this. The purpose of a myth is to end history. That is, history demonstrates movement, I'm reading now, in terms of forces beyond man and in judgment over man. Now that history shows that man, that history moves apart from man. There was a history before man, that man is not in control. Man is not in control. History demonstrates movement in terms of forces beyond man and in judgment over man. That is, the world goes on, man dies. Man dreams, and what happens to his dreams most of the time? They don't make it. Fall to the dust. Man tries and fails. His institutions disintegrate. He gets cancer. He loses his job. His children go on drugs. The car gets a flat tire. Life becomes a little more than waiting for the undertaker. Think about it that way. History demonstrates movement in terms of forces beyond man and in judgment over man is inescapably ethical. History is ethical. Shows the conflict between good and evil. That's the great battleground. Good versus evil. Shows man to be the actor, not the playwright, not the director. That's what we talk about, overcoming history. In history, and I use that metaphor because it's good. I think it makes it very clear. History shows that man did not write the script. Man plays the part, but he's not the director. He's not the playwright. You understand? He didn't write the play. He was Shakespeare. All earth is a stage. Man, we're all players. We have our fitting existence. We have our brief time on the stage. Well, in this metaphor, in the Shakespearean metaphor, man did not, he's an actor, and did not write the script, he's not directing it. But you see, man does not want simply to be an actor. He wants to write the script. He wants to be God. He wants to be the director. Man has never been content to be what he is. So, man uses myth. This is what I might call a cultural phenomenon. This is a bit of anthropology. Man uses myth to end history, which means to make himself the absolute ruler. To say, man uses myth to say, all of his myths, whether we're talking about primitive man, pagan man, he says, up to now, history has been in charge, but now I'm taking over. This is how I'm going to do it. If you want to see a clear explanation of this, I've mentioned it before in another connection. Let's go to Epcot, to those what they call them, attractions. And listen to what this, our spaceship work on that. Listen to what they say. It's boys are taking over this joint. We're not going to starve anymore. We're going to build planets in space, and we're going to have super planets. We're not going to die anymore. It's not soon. We're going to time here on Earth while we're going to start.
Good talk.
Well, it's going to be uglier padding more. We're all going to be mean and handsome and young. We're all going to have a button on. Everybody's going to be clear eyed and clean limbed and rule over angels. Here we are. But now they don't exactly say that. That's the point. Here, listen to that. It's very clear. Very pagan. Why? What myth? See, before, the ancient people used religious myths to do this. And by the way, there is a sense in which Christianity is a myth. In what sense is Christianity a myth? Of course, Christianity is a myth in this context. Don't you understand what I'm teaching? Don't go out of here saying Chambers said that Christianity is not true. It's not a myth in that sense. Does Christianity function to end history? It does. What it says is, up to now, man has been, up to a point now, man has been the victim. You see, what scientism tries to accomplish through science, Christianity accomplishes through the redemptive work of Christ. That is, things are in a mess. We have been victimized, but you see, someone, what it is, Christianity is not the message that we are taking over and we're going to solve the problems. We're going to work out the solutions. It is that God has entered history and overcome history in the sense that he has won the victory for us. In Christ, there shall be no more death. In Christ, there shall be no more pain. In Christ, we shall find joy. Y'all see that? It's been bad in the past, but wow, look to the future. So everything that Christianity offers in Christ, not in us, that's the fundamental difference in its character. Not in us, it is not. Listen, you see, in all other myths, it is man taking over. Man saying to history, you're a simpering old incompetent and you've messed it up long enough, I'm taking over. I am becoming God. And by the way, Epcot, I like Epcot, but I every time I go there, I can't really enjoy it because I see the significance of it. A lot of people go to Epcot, some of those attractions. They're going to church. These are temples. They're religious. There's hymns to man. The worship. You want to see churches built to the worship of man, some of those attractions are what they say, especially when you talk about the stage and the travel space. Well, anyway, the difference is in Christianity, man does not do it. It is done for us. We are saved by grace. Are y'all with me? Don't lose me now. If you lose me, don't stop me. We'll come back up and end again. Okay, so this is the function of a myth in history. What is a myth? It's an explanation of origins. It's an attempt to end history, to make the universe subject to man, that is, to overcome the obvious failure and the death and the destruction. And man wants control, you see. Through my myth, I control the world. I take over. Yeah. And by the way, this is why it's so dangerous. The neo-charismatics have taken their theology to its logical conclusion, or to one of its logical conclusions, and to say, well, Jesus, you see, the Christian message is, Jesus died to save us from sin. But the neo-charismatic message is, Jesus died to give us power in the universe. To save us, oh yes, but more than that, to give us power over death, over sickness, over death, that is, death now, and to give us power in the universe. See, Jesus walked on the water, he went solo walking on the water. Therefore, you get Pat Robertson saying, well, he's turned away to a few hurricanes from Virginia Beach, where there's people with power over nature, power to make it rain, power to make it whatever. Power on control. Or Satan is really sitting to somebody like wheat. You see, Jesus, notice Jesus was the Son of God, right? He came to save us people, men. He didn't have to make us a God. That's Satan's program. That's the Mormon, isn't it? In the name of God. That's why that theology is so deadly. It's called living up to your possibilities, living up to your privileges, taking all the power that you're powerful under. Power. It's interesting. One of the key words, or the operative words now, modern theology is power. Power of positive thinking. Power of the Spirit. Power, power, power. But you see, that's not the problem again. You want too much power. You see, hear me again. The Christian message is not that man wins the victory. The Christian message is that the victory has been won for man. Again, we are saved by grace. You understand that? It's a very clear and simple distinction. Okay, now, man uses myth to end the history and make himself the absolute ruler. That is, and notice the ancient religions did this, all religions do this. Our religion does this, but in a different way. Our religion ends history without making man a god. That is, our religion ends history. And do you understand what ending history means? Stops this inexorable progression of defeat and misery and unhappiness. Our history, our religion ends history, but it does it without making man a god, without putting man in charge. One of the reasons it's a true religion. Why? Because God is God and we're not God. And every other religion, in a sense, is to put man in charge.
Yes.
I thought
you mean
that it's
like getting rid of
bad things. Well, no, it means changing the order of things.
But still, this
isn't happening. Earth. Ultimately, yes. You mean that way it will end the existence of the earth ultimately. But it's going to before then, and more than that, it was going to send a new order of things, so that what has happened in the past, a man is. Goes along for the ride, he's the actor. He's going to become the playwright. It's a function of him. So, in this sense, Christianity, in its full definition, now hear me, Christianity is not a man. Because it does not make man the director of the playwright. It simply says that, but he's more than a natural. He's a fellow heir, but he's not God. Okay, you understand that? Now, so that, what is the means of achieving the goal of myth? And again, here we have another generic term, rather, we might call an anthropological term, and that is magic. Magic, interesting enough, Mike was in my cultural anthropology class. We're talking about magic this morning. Magic functions, magic means that this is how we use the myth. This is the handle that we have on the myth to end history. Magic has for its purpose the total control of man over man, nature, and the supernatural. Magic. And see, this is magic controls fate. Magic is all kinds of magic. I was talking about the release of my lecture this morning. Subjects that we have in our modern industrialized technological educated world are mainly vestigial magic, but magic doesn't say. I finished out the whole year without being too sick. We do that. I'm not good. Why? I'm not good. I'm not good.
Married on the half-mast.
instead of on the hour, you would never die. There is a lesson to the offense.
But you don't let the grand jury arrive on the way there. Yeah. I don't like it.
Take a dirty room to your house.
And you are really superstitious, aren't you?
Well,
that's the difference. I said, you know, this is what the term magic means. It's the ritual. It's what we do. It's how
the myth becomes operative. Which the myth becomes operative through magic. By the way, this is why they must always distinguish between magic and prayer. Many people, many anthropologists treat prayer as magic. And some prayer, so-called Christian prayer, is simply the practice of magic. And what does a magician do? Well, the only kind of magician was the witch who practices black magic. It doesn't control your negativity, but you get sick. The idea of transcendent form. That's what the term magic means. Magic has for its purpose the total control of man over man, nature, and the supernatural. The rain dance. When the rain, the rain dance. Or call Pat Robertson, either one. Control over nature and the supernatural. To gods. Disciple Satan and the God on your side. So there's an element of truth in that, you see. But again, this is why we must always realize that when we pray in Jesus' name. It is not we who have control, it is He by grace. Understand? It's not personal power. Any power that a Christian has is not personal power. It's the gracious gift of God. Yes?
Well, Pat Robinson prays that.
What?
He wants the personal power, but he's praying in Jesus' name.
Yes, but he wants the personal power.
He's called the personal power.
That is, if you really have faith and you have to not be sick and you'll not be poor, your crop will be destroyed by hail.
Or just kind of claim Jesus' Lord if you have
all that power, you see. Under the influence of Christianity, yes?
I was just thinking, don't some people have, you know, to say this rather poor, that some people have a little more clout with God? I mean, the prayer of a righteous man affects over the prayer of
yes.
So that has something to do with the person.
Yes, it does. Right. But it's not personal power in this sense. You're right. This has something to do with it. But in that he receives more grace at that point than others receive. But I guess the difference is this: is that man. Let me word it this way. Your point is well taken. Let me word it this way. The difference is that in Christianity, man is not the source of the power. But now, in other religions, he's not either. But the point is that man, God does not infuse power. Maybe this is a better way to put it. That in Christianity, God does not infuse this power in man. He exercises on his behalf according to his will. And in modern scientism and in many pagan religions, power is infused in man. In witchcraft it is. In satanic worship it is. The power is infused in man. In a lot of neo-charismatic theology, same thing. Power is infused in man so that it exercises at will. It is not what the Bible teaches. The power belongs to God. We are men. Never be anything but men. The power does not originate in us. And also, Jeff, the power is not at our command. See, in mythology, the power is at our command. Y'all see that? In other words, when I choose to exercise it, I will exercise it because the power is in me. Oh, no. We come to God and we ask according to your will. And he says yes or no. It is not at our command. At every point, man has hit it off the pass. Does this make sense to you? This is quite deep. Okay. Now, under the influence of Christianity, science escaped from magic.
ancient Greek science was magic. Ancient Greek math was magic. The Christian is God's vice regent over the earth, and science is the tool, is one of the tools, or is the tool given to man to establish and maintain that dominion. That's the proper role of science. That man is to use science to maintain his dominion over the earth on behalf of God, that God is the ruler. When science oversteps that role, it stops being science and becomes, once again, magic. And modern scientism, we're going to see, functions as magic. That is, we're going to conquer the world, right? We're going to conquer space, we're going to conquer disease, might even conquer death. What is our tool? What's our handle on all this? Science. So science becomes magic. Man is going to rule the universe. Man is destined for the stars. What's going to put him there? Science. Man is going to alter his own evolution. Because he's got a naughty gene, what's he going to do? He'll reprogram the gene. So all his kids will be like the people at Lake Wobegon. All the women will be strong, all the men good looking, all the children above average. You all know this in the years of theater. Culture and pride. What's going to make man Superman? Science. Science, science, science. The holy word of science. But what I'm saying is that with scientism, science once again has become magic. This is what I'm saying is, I'm not saying that every scientist is a magician or that every function of science is magical. I'm saying is that in modern scientism, science has once again become magic. That is, here it is. Let me just tie it all together. This myth, science as myth. Man is going to overcome history, which means he's going to take charge. No longer is nature going to be in charge, or whatever gods there might have been, no longer is fate, but man is going to assume control. He's going to write the play from now on. What is going to get him that control? Science. You see that? Quite clear to think about it that way. And that is our modern, that's modern man. That's the average American. In fact, if you want to sell a product, you just hang the name science on it. It's really funny how it works. If you want to see this, I'll give y'all clues how to look for this stuff, think about it. Next time you watch the television, the commercials come on. Look at all the ways, listen to all the ways the word science is used or misused to sell. A new scientific breakthrough. You know, they just hang the word science on it and say a scientific commodity, product, car wax, whatever it is, it all of a sudden becomes almost magical. By the way, you saw this. Remember the commercial for a Xerox machine, little monk. And he's supposed to copy all this stuff. He comes in with the whole staff. And his dad asks, "How did you get done so quick?" And what did he say? "Magic." What's it? Xerox machine. Almost. Science is the great benefactor. It doesn't kill us first. It doesn't bomb us or pollute the soils we can't eat any food or the water we can't drink or the air we can't breathe. It's going to save us. sarcastic. But do you all recognize this in modern thoughts? May I ask you, do you recognize this in your own thoughts? If you were educated to think this way, and I was to a lesser degree, but you were more than I was. Condition to think this way. Word science is good. Science is a good word.
Oh, there's the mad scientist, but science. He's on a science trip. Someone as good as LSD.
The high on science.
Notice at one time the preacher was the parson, the person. He was the person in the community. Now it's the scientist who is the parson.
He's the new parson. He's the new person. He's the new center of it.
He's the new high priest. He's the high priest of modern society. Scientist. And you see, it's science against religion. There never has been any conflict between science and religion. Everybody thinks there has. There's been a conflict between religion and religion. What a conflict is.
All the religion scientists.
Yeah, scientists is religion. That's what the problem is. Understand? There never could be a conflict between science and religion. Well, Christian religion. Y'all see that? So science is the new magic. Let's take up that. Wait a minute. Not time. Okay. What is the purpose? Are y'all with me now? Don't overdo this. I'll make sure you understand what we're saying as we're saying it. What is the purpose of modern science? The exercise of total control. Prediction, planning, and control. That is, through science we predict what. We predict the possibilities, we plan our program, and we control our future.
I control. So we decide. Until the nuclear plant blows up, Challenger aircraft blows up. All of a sudden, we're surprised.
But that's the idea.
Understand the prediction, planning, control, atmosphere. What enables us to predict science? We plan scientifically, and what gives us our control? Science.
Well, and I've already mentioned, I'll come back to the popularity of modern science. It is wedded, and science has become the new magic. That is, what the magician could do, the alchemists and the others could do in the Middle Ages, the scientists need to perform that function in our society. One of the things we're going to see if I have time to get to this, one of the problems in this is that the scientist is the least liberally educated man in the world at all. It's the most narrow. For instance, we're going to run things in my country at times. The scientists, almost all scientists, because of the kind of training they receive, are incompetent when they try to get over into the area of metaphysics. They're just simply not competent.
Well, that's true.
Well, it's amazing. I've read these guys, they get out of their area when they really get stupid. Isaac Asimov is out of this area, he gets foolish. I read all the letters. Illogical, prejudicial, hysterical. I read a letter to circulate trying to raise money by creationism. And it was simply hysterical. It was like a backwoods fundamentalist ignorant preacher lashing out against evolution from the position of ignorance. You know, and he embarrasses himself as if I'm being hysterical. Saying things like, if you want to be a you see these guys, but they really is. He's outside his field, really. It's irrational.
Any reference to that letter?
The idea that the moral majority is going to impose thought control. You know, that if you let this happen, then the true scientists will live in jail. You get all that. Then, see, get outside of the fields. Well, science is going to overcome history. Science eliminates the ethical struggle. Ah. See, before, who decided what was right and what was wrong? the minister decided, the teacher decided. Right? The clergyman. You want to know what was right or wrong? You ask the clergyman, or at least the philosopher. Now, if you want to know what's right or wrong, you ask the science. And by the way, sometimes we're not too comfortable with this. But I said in the opening lecture that science cannot speak to ethics? Well, it's not because they have drive. When do you pull the plug? Well, I'm sure in Dean Chambers' ethics class you dealt with this, but not in some of the class you're dealing with.
Modern
social problems. Are you dealing with this?
Yeah.
Well, the question I would raise, I'm not going to get into that. But you know how difficult it is, but it's a tremendous ethical problem. When you pull the plug, as a minister, probably you think that'd be very perfect, because you may be asked. I've had a plug pulled when I said it before. And after that, the gender to you this time. It's not good. I've been in that position more than once. And not a whole lot of times, but more than once. And but my point here, without getting into that, the issue I'm raising is what needs to be signed, but who decides? Who decides? There's the thing is, you see that they sort of running, the string has run out, and you realize in medical schools now they're getting professors of ethics in. Because they're trying to, because they realize that the science, that following the rules of science, you cannot address ethics. So they're trying to do some ethics. So now they have a professional ethicist. They save themselves a lot of money if you see an informed preacher. But, see my point? DNA, recombinant DNA, where we actually create different kinds of life forms, not from nothing, but by rearranging information in genetic code. Okay, so you got this scientist who's going to make this major breakthrough. Is it right or wrong? The consensus in our society is that the scientist wants to do it, but it's the way. Why? Well, that's science. Science is the high priest. Who's to say it's wrong? Now, the thing that is damning that is a nuclear bomb. Science, you know, went ahead and did it. And they said, well, you know, that's the case where we shouldn't have. But the general feeling is, understand what's up, that the scientist working in this lab wants to reorganize the genetic information and do something and produce clones or super people, super minds, even government now is worrying about this. Trying to say, this has created an area of tension, intellectual tension. Government, Congress is talking about this. In other words, should there be control? And if so, who is going to control it? Well, you're aware of this. There's been all kinds of hearings on it. Who's going to control my only point here is that this issue has come up. It can only come up, let me word it this way, this issue can only become a problem in a society with the mythology of where science is, where science has become mythology. And become scientism. Okay, we're
talking about eliminates the ethical struggle, science seeks to eliminate the ethical struggle. That is, to say that modern scientism wants to put man, let's say, beyond good or bad. Modern scientism tends to be pragmatic. The theology of the new science of scientism is pragmatism. That is, whatever works. The question is not, of course, the beg of the question is a logical fallacy. Making it very, for instance, I'll show you, I mean, you trace it back to this, I'm going to add this to this, we're over back this question. You say, well, take abortion as a good example. Or it's a very tragic example of this. So abortion is not approach first ethic, it's approach pragmatic, but it's rooted in social order. Well, unwed children are not rooted in social order. So we will make it legally, determine to open the legal door to get in there from unwed children. For the moment. Why? Because we write a letter to convenience which overpowers the right of the child to life. We will make that distinction because our society will be better off. Things will work better if we do it that way. Okay? Now, but we're an ethical people. We're not. You can't kill a living child and a mental one. So why not? Why did you push it back? Well, why not? So it's not, abortion is not an ethical thing. Okay. By the way, like I mentioned this before, if you think about abortion, you realize that you've got an abortion is dependent, like how I'm doing with others. And she talks about abortion. She talks about abortion being ethical. The mother's private moral choice. By saying that it's a child, it's a moral choice, it's not a child. Tries to take man beyond ethics, it does not work.
can't do it. Because pure pragmatism is a dead theology. Well, if you reduce it down to a little, in other words, it finally gets down to, if I'm more powerful than you and I don't want you, you're done for. Then it becomes the question of raw power, understand? Unwanted by whom? I'm not really wild about my man, that's not really. I think he burdens the earth. He's in my face all the time. I don't want him. Like a gun. Of course, see, my real problem is for you. And he's right there.
All the time for ethics.
You got that?
If a guy that doesn't want me has got this, the guy with the power, then we're going to start shouting ethics. But it's too late. So, this was one of the deadly fallacies of modern scientists. That is, who's going to decide? Science cannot decide. The modern scientism wants to. So say, well, notice, who decides whether the child is? Well, it's between the woman and her doctors. He's the scientist. He's the high priest to make that decision. And as the poster says, leaving out somebody. You understand? The doctor becomes, he's the scientist. So on what basis does he make the decision? Pure science. Let's see if this works. It's reductionist. But this is what the myth tries to do. Control. Absolute control. Control of our human mind is absolute control. Well, that's one of the reasons. What I'm trying to say to you, teach you, is that one of the reasons, not the only reason, maybe not the primary reason, one of the reasons why the babies are dying is because of this modern science fiction mentality I've been talking about the last few hours. The science idea of sacred science. Which brings us in our outline to the sovereignty of science. In the Christian view, with God all things are possible, and with Him nothing is impossible within the realm of total reality. The view of modern scientism is all things are possible for a man through and by the use of science. This is Star Wars. This is Epcot. This is Asimov. This is nonsense. I'll give an example. Now, do you think I'm making this up? I'll give an example. This is a shoulder right. Here's an example. Kenneth Huber, who's a specialist in planetary astronomy and a fellow of Britain's Royal Astronomical Society concerning the death of the sun. The sun's burning out. Not by the way, it's smaller today than it was yesterday. Scott's going on. What was that?
5 feet an hour.
5 feet an hour, and if you extrapolate this backward, the solar system could not have been as old as anything. Anyway, this is what he's saying. Talking about the death of the sun. This guy is not writing science fiction. At least he doesn't mean to be. He is, but he doesn't mean to be. Still another possibility would be to construct our own sun. Oh yeah, why not? Yeah, well, the thing about it is, it'd be funny if it weren't so tragic, but it might mean that this guy's deadly sober. That's still another possibility would be to construct our own sun, a source of heat and light which might be suspended in the sky and hold the hovering demons of cold and darkness at bay. This artificial sun would operate by subatomic energy. In the remaining years of grace, man might learn how to run the carbon cycle. Give us the future, we'll do it. Hydrogen, the fuel, is abundant, and other light atoms, such as lithium, are also plentiful sources of energy. Several millions of years of time at his disposal for research, man should be able to develop cheap, abundant, and manageable subatomic power.
What would it mean, friend?
He says, so where I came from, get off my back. I mean, give me a break. Right? Give us several million years and we'll build our own sun. That is, age doesn't kill us first. I mean, that's a few minor hits. But, now,
And so, and then again, I'm back to this. This is a part of this idea that we're going to try, that man shall travel to the stars. It is a part of this happiness. Give us something. That is, give us enough time. In the future, man will have to create that sun. We're calling people. We're eradicating all diseases. Mother, I've got an idea that God, that such things as AIDS, God allows them, perhaps causes them directly to come along every so often to remind us how stupid we really are. And how very fragile is our existence. Well, listen, not much has to go wrong when we're done for it. Not only as individuals, but as a race. You know, you're not the guy that you realize that actually, many experts saying that it's very possible that AIDS will kill as much as 29% of the population in the world. Anybody is going to full blast. And soon I don't have some way. It's interesting, though. Just about it's interesting. Just, you know, we got polio to take care of. Smallpox and measles under control, diphtheria, cholera, ill killers, tetanus, whooping cough, pneumonia, and the infectious diseases, like pneumonia, get those pretty well under control. And we even got our sin. We got free of the sin because penicillin, interesting how penicillin gave AIDS taken away, AIDS and herpes. Realized for a long time one of the real hindrances to sexual morality was gonorrhea, syphilis, and others, and there was no cure for it. Abraham Lincoln died of gonorrhea, probably, or syphilis. Alexander died of syphilis. Abraham Lincoln had that syphilis, kind of, but he's then came penicillin. As you go out to the Bronco on Friday night and get a shot Monday morning, everything's okay. But then came what? Herpes. What the herpes was all along? Herpes. I got a prediction right here. I believe if AIDS gets cured, something else will come along. I can't prove that. And I don't hope that it's true. I'm just saying that. Why? Well, I think God is reminding us it's a dangerous thing to fool with Mother Nature or fool with God. But anyway, so this is a part of the mythology of science. Man shall, in effect, become God. All things are possible for man through and by the use of science. And by the way, It's another piece of this. It's the same mind. They get this mind. Listen, you teach how this thing. You see this in that conversation. You see it in this. It's the fallacy of extrapolation. So extrapolation becomes a fallacy. What is the fallacy of extrapolation? You know what? First of all, you know what extrapolation is. Give me all time about this. What is extrapolation?
Give it enough time when you take the knowledge.
What is extrapolation? It's also worthy.
Remind yourself.
Take a known quantity or a known process or a known, and you extend it logically into the unknown. If I make 20 cents a day, I pay for a dollar, $2. If I live in a million years old, I'll make the X numbers. It's a full extrapolation. Fallacy of extrapolation, what is the fallacy of extrapolation? Yes. A, you're assuming that a process was for working the long range, shortly for working the long range, which it won't. Now, Mark Twain, as you know, made great fun of the 19th century evolutionists who extrapolated. And he figured, you know, it's in the best book. That was
side. It's on this.
I wish I knew what part of the page is on. Are you impressed?
I'm impressed.
Is Mark Twain's view, do you read Mark Twain's view on extrapolation? You haven't, you think you read it? Here's Mark, here's Mark Twain on extrapolation. In the space of 176 years, the lower Mississippi has shortened itself 242 miles. Which is true. The lower Mississippi has shortened itself 242 miles. That means the washing the way out to the land off the Delta. That's an average of trout over a mile in 30 years. Therefore, any calm person who is not blind or idiotic can see that the old Olytic Silurian period, just a million years ago, next November. Therefore, any calm person who is not blind or idiotic can see that in the old Olytic Silurian period, just a million years ago, next November, the lower Mississippi River was upward of 1,300,000 miles long and stuck out over the Gulf of Mexico like a fishing rod. And by the same token, any person can see that 742 years from now, the lower Mississippi will be only a mile and three quarters long. And Cairo and New Orleans will have joined their streets together and be plodding along comfortably under a single mayor and mutual lord of aldermen. There's something fascinating about science. One gets such wholesale returns of conjecture out of such a trifling investment of fact. That's beautiful, isn't it? You got that? Terrible, only a few years. 742 years. The Lord, the Cairo and New Orleans be the same town. I mean, you can't deny that. Well, now, you can see the fallacy of extrapolation. Now, let me teach you, I'm trying to teach you the same mind that extrapolates from microevolution to macroevolution, from general, from specific evolution to general evolution. That same mind extrapolates scientific progress of the last 100 years into the next 1,000 years. And constructs thereby his dream, such as when one goes some travel through space. The idea that that's the common mind. It's exactly the same mind.
You would say that the percentage of growth in scientific knowledge in the last 100 years, possibly would be.
Oh, it might be. It can't be maintained. I don't know for how long. Yeah, to extrapolate the progress from the oil lamp to the mercury vapor lamp. To say, okay, by that process, eventually man will build a lamp that generates its own energy for its own sun is simply not. In other words, it's the fallacy. This is exactly, I'm not making this up to you, that's exactly how the modern mind of scientist has said that since we went from the candle to the computer, we will go from the computer to who knows, like quantum leaps. It's not true at all. It's simply not true. Now, I'm not saying that amazing things won't be done, and I hope amazing things are done. I'm all for advances in modern medicine. If I go to the doctor, I'm even more for it. I'm for improvements in transportation. I'd much rather sit in my car with the air conditioner running in the stereo, playing nice music, comfortably cruising down the road and drive a horse. I've been a Model A. But I'd better have a newer car. And when I put it, I better go to Virginia this month. And next month, I'm much better to fly. I don't misunderstand that. Except the same, but they expect it. This is how they arrived at this. Understand? I know.
You see,
yes.
It's just being a student of the same that we were talking about last week and this week also, and have this bump in our head. It's kind of hard. 200 years, and I hear this in the same audience, 200 years ago, and this conversation was taking place at that point. So,
They would have said, anybody who brought up the idea of even thinking about flying from the moon at the end of the solar system, the idea that a machine no bigger than this could do the scientific things that it could do with the people that science, people would just say, this is a dynamic thing. Where do we draw a line?
And that's
what they pumped into us in our schooling. And that is
exactly the argument. You see, that is the fallacy of extrapolation.
They can handle 200 years.
What they're saying is, for instance, I had a guy, and I had every time I mention this, but I don't mention it too often, I say, we are not, you know, or toy old, I would say, space travel is a bunk. When I say that, we're not, in fact, the last time I said it, you know, I said that we're not going to travel through space. He said, it's very funny. This is the common, this is exactly what you hear. Well, now, 100 years ago, if you had told somebody about television and space shuttles and satellites, they would have said exactly what you're saying. You see the implied argument? The argument is, therefore, anything is possible. We simply extrapolate. So we're going to extrapolate what happened the last 100 years, the next 1,000 years, and the next 10,000 years, and we won't certainly. It's inevitable that we'll travel. Are you doing anything? Build our sons. That's exactly the argument. You understand? I'm glad you brought that out. That's what I was going to say. That is exactly the argument that's given. It's what is said. And you understand it is the fallacy of extrapolation.
It seemed like even 200 years ago, they were studying extrapolation, they would have said, oh, we deliver a machine that's a fallacy of extrapolation. I don't know that. But it would seem like that would be the same argument that we have here today.
But the fallacy of extrapolation is not that you cannot extrapolate, but you cannot extrapolate indefinitely. It does not go on and on and on. Other factors come in. For instance, you run into a technological dead end. You run into interfering forces. And the Cairo and all kinds of new laws are not going to be the same city. And so things, because too many things, for instance, it's just not that simple. Understand? You run into dead ends, you run into other factors come in, interferences. Oh, yes.
Do you think we've run into a dead end as far as space goes?
No, I don't think we have, but I don't think we're going to go through space. I don't think we're going to go through space. There are many more advances. I think, if you know my opinion, the next frontier in space is the unmanned spacecraft. I think that is one of the next great leaps forward.
Is that exactly what you mean?
Yes, but within known, within reasonable. In other words, unless you can't always predict the future, but in other words, reason comes into the picture. By the way, you know, don't you, the old fallacy, the logicians tell the old story of the fallacy to illustrate the fallacy of extrapolation. It's the story of the forms of it. It's a transformation of Greece, by the way. You find the story in different forms. So the basic story is, the form in which I first heard it was of a German farm girl who decided that she would like to be able to lift a cow. So she lifted a cat, who was just born, no trouble with it, carried it around and said, man, the next day, the difference was so small that she could lift the cat the same day. She could lift the tallest pair, it was in fact the same pair as the first pair. A few ounces. So she lifted. And so she lifted the second day, and there was no more trouble the second day than the first day. Not so much. The difference between lifting it the third and the fourth day as opposed to the third day was not noticeable. So the difference between the fifth day was not noticeable the way it was the fourth day. And so she kept this up until eventually the cow was full grown to 400 pounds and she was carried around. Makes sense, doesn't it? So you extrapolate the difference between day one and day
two. Here you have a limit to your human body, which I mean,
the fallacy that is something right now. Even though
even though, listen to me, when the cow is 300 days old, the difference between its weight between the 300th day and the 301st day is no different than the difference in weight between the first and second day. Even though that's true, and all along the line, you cannot, just because you can carry a cow, pick up a calf, a cow in the early days of its life, doesn't mean you can simply not extrapolate. That's the common story of the adoption of the child.
For those people that do extrapolate certain things, they must recognize that there is something that's ridiculous.
Yes.
So they just choose what they want to believe.
Yeah. But it's sort of in this romantic, when it comes to space, for instance, and other than medicine, you know, man's going to conquer. It's given enough time with the progress of the past to extrapolate the future. Which one of the problems with that is, how about extrapolating the problems? This is the most killing century in the history of the world. That more people have been killed. I don't know about dying of diseases. More people have been killed by the people in this century than any century in the world. So you try to lay it back and see how it comes up. But you see what I'm saying? It's a mind. What I'm trying to teach you now is this mindset that makes the general acceptance of evolution so popular. To extrapolation is the same mind that says that we'll make our own son. It's his own dictum. I repeat it to you. This is one of my few contributions to the discussion. I laid this on my professor at the university. I said, I get the list of unwritten rules of evolution. Given enough time, anything, everything was happening. And these are sufficient cause. And my experiment, given enough time in the past, anything must have happened. Give us enough time in the future, and we'll just come home. Well, true. You cannot extrapolate, for instance, when certain amino acids are formed through heating of gases, you cannot extrapolate that into host cells or cells. Blood's dry. Makes my metaphors. Did y'all see that? Well, the modern mind of stuff, that's the modern mind of scientism. And it doesn't work. It's like modern mind of, you see this in all forms. You see the field of education. Well, what happens is pretty soon you start running around in circles and you're in the dead end.
And it works that you're more educated than you do, you learn how to think about it. When I was in Ohio, I always had a running battle with the experts in education. The guys that get their degrees and their administrators. And my university, actually, my degree was one of the reasons I'm not recognized for education. Well, they used the schools and the institutions of their life. And at the school my kids went. It's like they're on about a 12-year cycle. You see, there's only ways things pass. Has education been improved since the one-room schoolhouse? Well, I mean, in a way, yes. You know, we change, we improve. Look how much we've changed and improved in the last 50 years. Look how much we've changed and improved in the last 40 years. So, this mind, extrapolated mind, says, therefore, we shall change and improve and so they keep on writing these dissertations. But you see, to improve, you have to change. To change, you do something new. There's only so many ways to teach a class. No one person to teach a method. So what they're doing now is going around circles. You read the history of education. How do you learn around circles? But I estimate about 12-year cycle. I guess most of them are now. You got that? Now we're going back to traditional. They went to a new man out about the old. Understand? They change it. It's hugely expensive. They go from the old classroom to the traditional classroom, very smart, you can teach them. And now all they're doing is going around circles. Full education is doing it. Going around circles, in my opinion. Why? Because that is, what is new now will be old pretty soon. What do they do again? Why? Because once you cannot improve indefinitely. There are only so many ways to teach a class. Right? I mean, this is just basic.
And
you simply run out. But this my point is, this extrapolating mind assumes that we should improve it down. Not that there will always be fine tuning in the light of changing social conditions. I misunderstand that. But it's kind of like neckties. Save your neckties, boys. Why? There's only so many ways to have a necktie. And a wide, everything in between. But I threw away all my 10 ties in 1965. And I wish I had, they're all back. I'd give them to you. I wouldn't wear them again. But I'd give them to you guys for their new name. Remember the necktie. What do they do? Like the hemlines, they go up and they go down. Sometimes they go way up, and sometimes they go way down. But they can't go sideways. They go up and they go down. Ties get thicker and they get thinner. They get thicker and they get thinner. See, extrapolate. See, in 1961 it was real thin. In 1966 it was wider. And if you were really scientific, you figured by 1985 you'd be wrapped around it. You know, piled like this, you know. Is my piling okay? No, you see. Only got so wide that it started getting thin. And by the way, ties can only get so skinny. You know, I've seen some around that are pretty limited, you know. It's kind of like a shoestring, you know. You get my point? The thing just like, after a while, take the internal combustion engine. It's vastly improved, but still internal combustion engine. You can improve the way you spark it, you can improve the way you burn the fuel, you can make it more efficient than they have, but still, that doesn't mean that eventually we're going to have an engine that will run 500,000 miles on a teacup of water, you know, just with all the energy out of the water, and what's it going to do that? I don't think so. Horrible. You get this. There's a big debate when Roger Bannister wrote the 4 mile outdoor mile. I was in high school. Remember that raised the question, what's the perfect mile? That was supposed to be the perfect mile, right? And now we had high school kids breaking the 4 minute mile, but that was a big thing. I remember when Roger Bannister wrote the 4 minute mile, and it was determined that it was as fast as anybody. What's the record now? 352 to 353 or something like that?
349.
You see, God, now what is the, and so we got this big discussion, what's the perfect mile? Now, if a guy can run it in 4 minutes, which is a little more exertion, he can run 359.5, right? Surely, hasten up a couple of steps along the way, run 358. He's down to 340, what's
340?
349. If a man can run a mile in 349, he can run in 348. Right? Well, if he can run a 348, he can run a 347. If he runs a 347, he can run a 346. If he can run a 348, you see, it's like carrying a cow, same thing. Well, it's a fallacy. You understand that? All I want you to understand is that it's a fallacy and that our culture commits it in the area we're talking about. Okay. We come now to science and the utopian mentality. What is the utopian mentality? What's utopia? Remember Restoration history, Robert Owen, utopianism. What is it?
Perfect society.
No unhappiness, no misery, no want. Communism is utopianism. The promise, and note this, interestingly enough, what is the philosophy, the political philosophy of the Soviet Union? What's it called? What's the real technical exact term for the political philosophy of the Soviet Union.
You might know.
Very instructive. What is it?
Scientific socialism. Scientific socialism. The promise of a workless world in which everyone lives well. The work ethic is being attacked. A lot of people are kind of working on that right now. We've got some of our students are working on that. How it comes to academics. The promise of a workless world in which everyone lives well. Do you realize that a university that's being taught is being taught that that's inevitable? Why? Why must we get rid of the Protestant work ethic? The man will not work, but the Pauline ethic is what? The man will not work, neither let him eat. You've got to get rid of that. Why? Because science is going to render physical labor obsolete. Science is going to render intellectual labor obsolete. By the way, a part of this new scientism is the idea that men, that machines can think. It's interesting how many people think that, what's that, the Knight Rider? You amazed how many kids think that's plausible. R2D2. The car, which really becomes a person, it's capable of intellect.
So
the machines are going to now take over the manual labor. Again, you extrapolate.
You go from the holes in the farm tractor to the guy who sits in the sitting room in this air conditioned cubicle and push buttons. Farm without makers. No people.
Well, I'm not saying I don't know how close we'll come to that. I know that we'll never build artificial machines that will have that way of thinking in the human sense. Because they can't do that, they can confuse. Confusing is not thinking. You understand what I'm saying? You see, there's a difference. What it means that data, there's a difference. There's data, there's information, and there's knowledge. And there's wisdom. Data is raw material. Information is useful raw material. The data is, let's simplify it. Information is not knowledge, it's simply information. And knowledge is not wisdom. For that reason, computers never think in the full sense. Get that? Information is not knowledge. Knowledge is not wisdom. Okay. But the idea, the part of this modern mind of scientists is that a workless world. It's inevitable, you see. Extrapolate. Look how much easier they are now. And the GE carousel of progress out of the Magic Kingdom. I love that. He's on the best day. He's on the best day. And I can remember. I can tell that stuff. I can remember. I'm old enough. I remember an icebox. But anyway, the idea is that machines are going to take over everything, and man is going to have to get the act to construct a society and work this world. Because human work will be replaced by machines. Therefore, we're going to construct a new ethic, a new culture, a new way of living things. Utopia. This is a part of it. Scientific socialism. I love that. That's one of the reasons why it's so hard for conservatives to fight the welfare state. Because behind the welfare state are the social scientists who say, well, eventually nobody's going to work. Scientists, do you understand that? That's a part of the thinking. Scientists self-consciously offer themselves as the vanguard of the new Renaissance. Who is going to lead us into this new world where no one works? Who is going to guide us to utopia? Answer, the scientist guides to utopia, the new priest. Scientists often think of themselves as the guardian of society. Question? Well, what are the ethical requirements of the promised scientific utopia? Number one, the removal of ethical absolutes. You have to be pragmatic. Close. Secondly, the opening of the mind to new possibilities, unbounded optimism, about which we've been saying so much. The willingness to admit that scientific man is his own God, admit that, which leads to the removal of God. You see, in the new age of science, God simply cannot be permitted. Why? Because you can't have two gods. No man can serve two masters. Man must be God. Why? Because in this new scientific utopia, man must decide about life and death. And human body and man must have absolute. That's the thing back we were talking about last time. What is the purpose of magic? To gain absolute control. To move up. Man wants to be in control. And you cannot have a God. You cannot have man answering to God if he's going to be in control. You can have the force. And again, this morning in Cultural Anthropology, we talked about that is the religion of animatism. Not animism, but animatism. That's a term in cultural anthropology. That is the idea that the whole universe is permeated by an impersonal, non-individualized force to which you can tap into for unlimited power. That was the theology of Star Wars. The force. Tap it, it's theirs in everything. It's impersonal, you can tap into it, and you tap in front of it. You know the secret, as the Jedi Knights did. By tapping into the force, then you become God. Overcome space, overcome gravity, live forever, overcome death. Remember, who was the name of the old man who was killed by Darth Vader and his cloak and his body disappeared? Obi-Wan. Overcome death. Why? By tapping into the force. Well, it's interesting that why that kind of theology is rising. It's interesting, get rid of God, they've got to have something. The establishment of scientific absolutism, the passionate dedication to scientism. Example, the fervent, I've already talked about it. Fervent, passionate desire of those working in the space program to find evidence of life on other planets. Supposedly, science isn't the object. It's interesting in discovering the truth, not making a case. You see, it's interesting that the scientists, like the Russians, are frankly guilty of practice scientism. That is, the Russians very frankly say the main interest of the program, the science space program, is to prove there isn't a God. A scientist is supposed to seek truth, not make a case. And many in our space world are trying to make a case. Y'all don't remember this, but did he the first man in space for us? What's his name? Yuri Gagarin. Yuri Gagarin was the first man in orbit to Russia. And when he said, came back, first part of the galaxy. I looked for God, and I didn't see him. That was the point. Looked for God, and he wasn't there. To which one of the American astronauts in training was Alan Shepard. He said, he had stepped out of his spacecraft and he'd seen me. Open that door, baby, and you'll see him. But that was the response. Good answer. But interesting. You see, they were Russians were trying to make a case. So much of science, you see, is an evolution, you see it in much of the space program. And I don't come out of this, having chosen on the syllabus, not trying to seek truth with me. See, science seeks the truth. Scientism tries to make the case.